From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Hello! Today we're talking states of origin. Not the rugby league kind, obviously. You'll have to go to another podcast for that. But we're diagnosing chauvelode. Symptoms may include irritability and anxiety. And we're getting back in touch with friends. I'm Louise Rugendyke, and welcome to the first ever episode of The Televisionaries. Here with me today are my frenemies from the Herald and Age newsrooms. We have Spectrum Deputy Editor Kylie Northover. And calling in from our LA studio is our Culture Editor-at-Large, Michael Odato. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Louise.
How are you both?
Very well.
Very good. Very good here.
Very good. Great. We're kicking off today with Stateless, the ABC's first big drama hit out of the year. One of the stories in it is inspired by Cornelia Rau, the German-Australian woman who was wrongly detained in the Baxter Detention Centre in 2005 during the federal government's mandatory detention program. It has a big-name cast, Kate Blanchett, who also co-produced the series, Yvonne Strahovski, who plays the Cornelia character Sophie. Faisal Barzi is Amir, an Afghan refugee. Plus, there's also Asha Keddie, Jai Courtney, Marta Dusseldorp, and British actor Dominic West. It's a story about refugees, but the cast is largely white. Michael, did we need Kate Blanchett to show us the truth about our detention centres?
Look, we probably didn't, but I think what's this is kind of a bit more than that, I think. I loved this. I found it fascinating. I kind of consumed all the episodes I had as quickly as I could get them. I think what this shows us, it isn't just a story about people who come to Australia seeking refuge and end up in these centres, which is why I think, I mean, just to talk to the point you just made, which is that it's a refugee drama where so many people seem to be white, that there are actually four threads in this story. One of them is a refugee story, the Amir story, which is Faisal Barzi's story. The other parallel stories are the manager of the detention centre, played by Asha Keddie, one of the guards, played by Jai Courtney, and the Cornelia Rau-inspired story, which is one of the four threads, which is about a white, ostensibly Australian woman residing in Australia who, because of mental illness, ends up in the detention system. What this reveals, I found more than what I knew or presumed about the refugee experience, was the complexity that surrounds the administration itself, the running of the camps, the impact that people, that the process has on not just the people in detention, but the people who operate detention. And I think in particular, Jai Courtney's story is in the end, I mean, they're all affecting, but I was particularly affected by the Jai Courtney story, because here is a guy who's a contractor working for a security company in a detention centre. His job is he's a prison guard, in effect. And through the course of the series, you watch the process kind of break him to pieces. And I think that's what's kind of revealing. Through this process, everybody seems to be kind of cracking up. You know, Asha Keddie's character, Claire, who runs it, she's kind of peeled bare and broken down. And it just kind of highlights the hideousness of the whole system. I thought it was a remarkable, remarkable drama.
Yeah, everyone is left broken, isn't it? It's just not
the incredibly,
people behind the right.
Incredibly.
It's not the people just behind the fence. It's the people on the other side of the fence.
There are casualties kind of all over the place here. It's a gripping, depressing, very compelling piece of TV.
Kylie, before we go to you, let's have a listen to one of the scenes in the show. This is Dominic West talking to the Sophie character.
And if you can allow yourself to be as vulnerable and as true as this little baby, then we'll find our internal strength. If we can't do that, then we're going to stay in this prison that other people have created for us. Cut off from happiness, cut off from success, cut off from your potential to love and be loved. But worst of all, cut off from fulfilling your destiny. So I say to you all, tonight, take off the suit! Take it off!
Kylie, you're a fan of cults, and of course, the first episode in particular... the first episode in particular does focus on the Kate Blanchett and Dominic West's characters and how they drew the Cornelia character, Sophie, into their cult. I suppose, how do you rate Dominic West's Australian accent? He does play the leader of the cult.
I've never been less attracted to Dominic West.
Really?
I am strongly attracted.
It is hideous. They're hideous.
He did it so well in this. He was horrendous. I hadn't actually realised he was supposed to have an Australian accent. I actually thought he was doing a sort of a generic British accent. So there you go. That might be telling.
Well, he's an Australian character. So, I mean, I was kind of assuming it was an Australian accent. He was sort of dipping in and out of it. But, you know, it was, yeah, probably the generic.
Do you know what, though? The drama, the story is so compelling. I didn't really focus so much on his accent.
Yeah.
The Cornelia Rau story could be a standalone miniseries on its own, let's face it. But I think it's a really interesting way into the bigger story as well.
Yeah.
Because even just that cult storyline is fascinating and compelling.
I couldn't believe, like, I had a pretty good memory of the Cornelia Rau story, but the whole part of the dance cult was a real sort of black spot for me. And I was just like, this can't be true. And then little old Google, and what do you get? So on their website, we'll say, when you Google it, it is frequently asked questions, not a cult. So we won't call it a cult. That's the one that, really drew Cornelia Rau in.
Mm.
There is something incredibly gruesome about them. I think they play, obviously, that sort of couple who kind of ensnare Yvonne Strahovski's character. Mm. There's a hideousness to that. There's quite a sort of hideous madness in Kate's performance, I think, that's sort of, you know, it's a fascinating place. I think if you are in her position as the creator of a show, you are steering its story in a sense, and you're also an actress. You're going to find yourself a small place to hide in this story. It's an incredibly compelling place to hide, and it's very prominent in the first hour of the series, but really not after that. And that was kind of the most fascinating thing to me, was sort of the Kate component. She sort of, it's not that she's not dealt with, but the that part of the story sort of steps back once Yvonne is kind of in Barton detention center, and sort of then inside the center, you're just kind of watching all those people kind of peeled apart piece by piece.
Yeah, I suppose.
I think it's also, as well as in front of the camera, I think the crew is amazing on this as well. Two female directors, amazing.
Yep.
Jocelyn Morehouse and Emma Freeman. I mean, it looks amazing. I think it's really interesting the way they've done the non-linear narrative, because that can sometimes get a bit messy, but I thought it worked really well, particularly using it to explore Sophie's mental illness and her flashbacks and her confusion. Yeah. I just thought it was brilliantly done, really well done. Amazing.
I think also what is sort of really striking about it is that because of the subject matter, I think there is an expectation, not just because it's about refugees, but also because it's on the ABC, that somehow it's going to be preachy. And I actually found the opposite. I found it kind of incredibly unjudgmental. The greatest sympathy it elicited from me was not just to Amir's story, but I was really broken by Cam, which is Jai Courtney's character. His journey is heartbreaking. And even at the beginning, when I'm thinking, well, okay, so I can focus all of my dislike on Asha Keddie here, because Claire is she's the bureaucrat, she's running the centre. In the end, she's so broken apart herself by this process that you kind of at the end you're a bit like, wow, it didn't judge anybody, it judged everybody. Everyone's, you know, the kind of the hollow sadness of everyone's journey through this is revealed to you. And I actually thought it was very. One of the most compelling parts of it was that it was not preachy. I think really when you're watching TV, the last thing you want to is to be lectured to, and this doesn't really lecture to you. It kind of just takes you there and sits you in a corner, and it's grim.
And it also isn't neatly wrapped up at the end. It's really, it's almost
I mean, I kind of expected at the end of it, I was a bit like, so there's a second series, right? And a few people were like, oh, I'm not sure there is. And I was thinking, oh, I kind of think I was needing a second series. I need to know what happens to these people. I found myself really, like, it took me there. I was transported in a way that doesn't happen. The last time I feel like I felt that was with Ladies in Black, the Australian film, which was set in David Jones, where at the end of the film, I very much was like, what happens now? Like, I need a spin-off TV series. I need the story to go on. I'm not ready to say goodbye to these people. And I felt that very much with Stateless. At the end, the good, the bad, all of it, I was at the end of it, I thought, gosh, I don't want to say goodbye to these people. I need to see their stories kind of move on.
Well, unfortunately, that's what we're going to have to do. Look, I will just say I totally agree with you, especially with the Asha Keddie character, Claire. It's really, for me, the first time I've ever sort of felt some small skerrick of sympathy for anyone on the government side of the people in detention sort of argument. I thought she was fantastic. Anyway, now we're just going to sort of slip into Michael's favourite game, which is 6 Degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. Okay, so this is based, obviously, on the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game, where every actor in Hollywood can be linked to Kevin Bacon in 6 steps or less through their acting credits. Except today we're going the full Mendo and linking to an actor from one of our featured shows, to Ben Mendelsohn. And today it's Jennifer Aniston. Kylie, Michael, any ideas?
I don't have it. I mean, this is really, I just feel like this game lives in the part of my brain that is preoccupied with reruns of Doctor Who and fried chicken. The irony is I really like Ben Mendelsohn. He's a really lovely actor, and I don't think I've disliked anything he's ever done, and yet somehow I'm inexplicably at a loss to offer you anything that might get us to Jennifer Aniston.
Can we have a clue?
Let me have a think about it. And I might give you a clue the next time. Have a little think about it. And then you've got until the end of the show to think about it. But just no Google. Now we're moving on to our big question of the day, which is, speaking of peak TV, my question for you is, are you suffering from showverload? Symptoms include anxiety and irritability. And one cure is 14 days of self-isolation so you can catch up on all the TV you're missing out on. We're living in the era of peak TV, but is too much TV killing TV? There are 6 main streaming services, plus the catch-up channels, plus free-to-air, plus a group of smaller streamers, like sort of such as Hey You and that kind of thing. There's too much to watch. Audiences are far more fragmented than they've ever been, which means it's tough for any show to break through and become a true hit. Kylie, are you suffering from showverload?
I suppose I am, in a sense, in the same way that I used to go to the video library and, you know, when you'd get your 5 for $10 or whatever it was.
Mm.
And then you go, oh, I have to find 5. But I don't know. It's a bit of a first world problem to have, isn't it, really? I understand the choice paralysis. And I have particularly noted it when I give my phone to my 7-year-old to choose something. Whereas if I give her a choice of 2 shows, she'll choose one. But if I give her the phone, she starts doing the scrolling. Oh, I don't know. So, yeah, I don't know. Is it really something to complain about? I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's complaining about it. I think it's too much to watch, but how do we find a true breakthrough show that we can all watch together? I think that's sort of kind of maybe
it's sort of a little bit of projecting forward FOMO, isn't it? Like you'll choose the wrong thing and waste your time or something.
I mean, I do think TV is killing TV. I think there is too much peak TV. There's a couple of reasons for that. I think because we now have to choose between how we watch a show, do I binge it or do I watch it weekly? And if I binge it, maybe I don't notice it so much because every show, I'm just consuming a show a week in a week and I move on. But I did find in the last couple of months, as the streaming sector has kind of shifted back to weekly dropping of shows, I am back in a situation I feel like I've either not been in for years or I've never been in, which is trying to watch, you know, trying to kind of be watching 5 or 6 shows at once and watching them each week. And I'm a bit like, oh my God, like which one's even available now? When does that one drop online? Have I seen that episode? I actually do feel like we're a bit overloaded. I think peak TV isn't actually in practice a great thing. I think what it does is, you know, when let's call them the olden days, you used to commission the TV industry in America, for example, would commission maybe 150 scripted shows, which means there's a process to get those shows on the air. And that process involves going through a lot of other shows that didn't get made to make the 150 that you make. They now make 400 shows. Now, we've not discovered additional genius out there. There's no additional genius. What we actually have is 150 shows and another 350 that wouldn't have made the cut in the olden days.
Yeah.
So we just have this fatter pool of shows that we're kind of trying to get through. Now, there are more great shows, but there are also many, 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 many more mediocre shows. And I think we're caught in a kind of, it's a bit like, it's like TV Frogger. You're kind of jumping to a new lane. Every jump, there's like shows flying at you. As Kylie said, are my friends watching this? Are my friends not watching this? Am I in this? Do I have anyone to talk about this show with?
Yeah.
You know, what did you? So you kind of, it is a bit, it's hectic, you know. Yeah. And in America, I mean, you talk about 6 streaming services. There are 16 here and there are more coming here that will not come to Australia because just simply because of different market sort of forces. It's terrifying. I mean, where you sort of sit there, you know, you're bombarded, I feel like, at the moment. And I don't know that we're that better off. It is great to have more really great shows, but it's equally not a byproduct of the boom in shows. Yeah. The fact that we've got more amazing shows is because a couple of streaming services don't care if nobody watches them.
Yeah.
So shows that could never survive a commercial test but were artistically brilliant suddenly can be made with a business model to back them. And that's a hugely amazing thing. It didn't take 400 scripted shows to get there. It just took one or two brave streaming services. So it's a tricky mess in lots of ways.
Do you think we absorb TV as well as we used to? Because I was thinking, I don't rewatch shows like I used to. Like back in the day, you had a favourite show that you'd watch and then you'd watch it, you know, once a week when it was on TV, and then if you were lucky, you'd get the videos or you'd even buy the DVD and you would rewatch it over and over again. And there is, I'm just trying to think, the last show that I did that for was probably 30 Rock just with having the DVDs, but there is nothing that I rewatch anymore because you don't have time because there's another show to watch after that. So I think you don't tend to take in the complexities of so many great shows like you used to.
I would say yes and no. I mean, I think some of that's just growing old. I think as we grow older, we get married and we have children and we have families, and you have other time pressures sort of impact you. So I think kind of the joy of indulging like a whole weekend of something is an indulgence for the young. I think when you're older, you've got a million other things to worry about. At the same time, I battle to watch old shows, and I love old shows. And I've always felt, as someone who worked in a space where my professional focus was new shows, old shows have remained very recreational for me. I like watching old shows because I don't have to think about what I'm going to ask the producer or what I'm going to ask the actor. So for me, a lot of new content is research. So old content, reruns, the things that you kind of indulge in that, it's recreational. Old TV is recreational in a way that new TV sometimes can't be.
And that, I actually think that's one of the good things about some of the streaming services is you can go back and rewatch stuff. They do have the old stuff that probably nobody's actually watching, but you know, I've been going back and watching Spaced when I do have time, but yeah, it is different now.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of old shows, we're now going to have a bit of a rummage in the back of the DVD drawer and take a look at Friends. It ran for 10 seasons, ending in 2004, and turned its cast of Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, David Schwimmer, Matthew Perry and Matt LeBlanc into superstars pretty much overnight. The cast are now reuniting for an unscripted special, and they're all banking at least US $2.25 million for turning up, sitting on a soundstage and talking about the old days. I mean, but really that is pocket change compared to the general US $425 million that HBO Max have also shelled out for the five-year streaming rights. But it's not just the money. Audiences still can't get enough of Rachel, Joey, Monica, Chandler, Phoebe and Ross. It's still one of the most popular shows on Netflix. Michael, you've got to have Friends, don't you?
You sort of do. Look, I mean, I think if anything could poison our relationship with Friends, and I have massive affection for Friends. If anything could poison our relationship for Friends, it's the knowledge that they're getting $2.25 million to go back and look at it, and we're not. it's one of those shows. I feel like, I mean, if I try to kind of understand why I like it or where I picked it up in my 20s, and I think what Friends then was to me, and maybe to everybody who catches it in their 20s and sort of stays with it, which is probably what happens. I don't know that anyone is tuning in at 60 and thinking it's amazing. Is that it's not so much a reflection of your life in your 20s, but a reflection of the life you fantasized that you were living in your 20s. I think we all fantasized this thing where we all had a coffee shop and all our friends hung out and we were funny and we were amazing and we were really pretty and we had romances. The truth is our lives were probably not like that at all. But Friends gave us kind of permission to fantasize in that. And I think that's why it kind of hangs around with us. Kylie, you're dying.
I hated them. I think our lives were probably much more interesting than theirs.
I think you were living the life. I mean, we're all living your life in a way. I think you were just being more honest about it while we were watching Friends.
So, Kylie, you didn't have a Rachel cut.
No, do you know what I may have actually in the late 90s?
I think every woman had a Rachel cut.
Oh, no, I just hated them. To me, they looked a lot older than they were meant to be, which is, you know, that's a popular thing that we see on American TV anyway. The only time anyone ever had an alcoholic beverage was when it was some kind of issue of the week when someone was an alcoholic. Oh. I don't know. Joey was just a sleaze. he's not charming at all. He's revolting.
Yeah, I agree. Chandler, I look at too, and I was like, how on earth are you a functioning human being? The thing is, too, there's one theory, too, why it is so popular among millennials is because it shows them a life that they don't have now. There's no phones, no internet. They're face-to-face with their friends, sitting around talking in apartments that millennials today or anyone could never afford.
Of course.
No one could back then either.
Oh, somehow. But hang on, Rachel worked at a coffee shop and then Bloomingdale's. Yeah. You know, that gives you a decent income, surely, to have it
Not decent enough to afford bigger than a cupboard in New York.
Yeah, that even back then when I hadn't been to New York, I knew that apartment was ludicrous.
They were nonsensically large apartments, yeah. I've got to say, yeah. Which is television's great lie. I mean, most sets look like amazing houses to live in, even though they're like five times what most of the people living in them could afford.
But at least Seinfeld, which I remember being on at the same time, it was a bit of a, you know, Rolling Stones Beatles thing.
Yes.
Among my friends, you either watched one or the other. Mm. And at least Seinfeld, the apartments were small and a bit grubby and...
Yeah, Jerry was a well-known, well-off comedian and he lived in a terrible place.
Yeah, but at least it was a bit more realistic.
Yeah. Look, I was always watching...
New York.
Yes, it is New York. I was always watching... Speaking of New York, I was watching Mad About You. That was, I think, my break from... I mean, I watched Seinfeld and I found Mad About You much more. It's a slightly darker and entertaining. But whenever I look at Friends now too, it's so bland and safe and white. And I just do not get how in... When all the comedy on offer today on all the streamers... How it is still a thing. Like, it's so safe. Like, maybe we just want a hug. Is that it? We just want a TV hug?
But I would have thought the millennials would find it highly problematic as well. Being all white and, you know, I think there's a lot of homophobia in it. I know they had a token lesbian and everything, but I don't know. I would have thought it'd be problematic.
No, they just want the apartment. Mm. And, you know, uncomplicated coffee orders. There's no oat milk at Central
Park.
There's just one decision. That's it. There's one decision. You want cappuccino. That's it. All right. Just as we're heading on the home straight, I'll just check in with what you're both watching. Kylie, what's on your TV list at the moment?
I have just I finished watching it because it's only six parts, which is novel these days. I've been watching I Am Not Okay With This on Netflix.
Okay. What's it about?
It's great. It's sort of a John Hughes-y teen drama, highly stylized, lots of there's these 16-year-old kids dancing to 80s songs, but I kind of like it. It's highly stylized.
Are they actual teenagers or are they my favourite 25-year-olds playing 16-year-olds?
No, they're actual teenagers. They actually look like fetuses to me. I actually am really enjoying it. I have really enjoyed it. I'm hanging out for the second one. Sort of horror.
Well, it's a horror. So there's not quite a bucket of blood, obviously, but...
Sort of, not quite.
Not quite.
So it's more sort of in that sort of classic horror trope of teenager developing, you know, telekinesis or, you know, that kind of puberty horror trope, which I love.
All right, very good. Michael, what's on your list?
Look, a bit same, but different. I'm watching Everything's Gonna Be Okay, which is the Josh Thomas comedy about an Australian gay man whose father dies and he inherits two teenage American siblings that he has to move to America and live with, in effect. Again, similarly, weirdly, something's changed generationally. There are teenagers playing teenagers here. But, you know, so they do look incredibly young. It's a very funny show. It's a very tender show. It's really beautifully put together. It kind of lives in its gentle moments more than its screamingly funny moments, although there are some screamingly funny moments. And it's also it's a show that's been dropped weekly, so it's kind of it forces a ritual or a habit onto you. You know, it's a show that there's 10 half hours. It's up to the ninth. I've watched now 9 of the 10. So I'm as deeply invested, not just 9 episodes invested, I'm 9 weeks of my life invested, which is a really much bigger investment.
That's a commitment.
Than just 9 episodes. It really is. And it's incredibly tender. There's something incredibly tender about it that it's gentle. It's a very, and the people in it are funny but terribly fragile. It's one of those shows that you just sort of, it's an intimate and very, very gentle experience. It's lovely.
Oh, great. Well, just to wrap up, I'm watching Cheer, the 6-part Netflix documentary that follows the Navarro College Bulldogs cheer team. It is also, incidentally, featuring teenagers. It's not the pom-pom cheering type that you see in the movies Bring It On. This is real physical, athletic cheering where they throw each other up in the air and do all sorts of fantastic tricks. Anyway, even though it's a documentary, it is the characters in it are as if they were written from a story. It is absolutely phenomenal. It's very much in the vein of Friday Night Lights, my other sort of pet favourite show, which is, you know, small town college football. But anyway, it's fantastic. If you want to see young women get concussion as they sort of hit the mat, highly recommended. No, that's not to make it sound bad. It's just it's there. That sounds horrible. No. It is also if they are. It just shows the real athleticism of everyone involved and the drive of them, because this is a life changing thing for them. But it's also the injuries they go through are horrific. So anyway, hopefully that is a recommendation and not a put off. Anyway, we're just now going to finish off with our 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. Guys, any ideas? How do you connect Jennifer Aniston and Ben Mendelsohn?
Did he play the alcoholic boyfriend in Friends?
No, I did watch Friends, and I can honestly say I'm pretty sure that's somewhere Ben Mendelsohn did not go.
I will give you a hint. There is an Australian connection. Okay, in between Jennifer and Ben is an Australian connection. She was a guest star on Friends.
Oh, okay. So that means that has to be Sarah Murdoch or Elle Macpherson. I think Sarah Murdoch was sitting in a cafe and Elle Macpherson, I think she was also sitting in a cafe. That's all anybody ever did in that
show. That's the whole show, yeah.
That is the show, yeah, yeah.
Okay, look, let's listen to a clip from Friends.
Do we have to?
And unfortunately, yes, that is part of the podcast. Sorry, Kylie, block your ears.
It's nice to meet you, Janine Lacroix.
I didn't know that. Well, what a pretty last name. So, where are you from?
Australia. I just moved here a couple of weeks ago.
From the land down under?
Yeah.
I didn't know that either. So, what do you do?
I'm a dancer.
You're a dancer? She's a dancer.
Oh, that laugh track.
I'm not sure I'm any better off knowing. But maybe can I go like I'm gonna just be really random here and think of all the things if it goes Jennifer Aniston to Elle.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Then yep. Michael, you got it.
Well, no, but I'm gonna say it almost certainly. Just logic tells me, because Elle Macpherson is not much of an actress. Is the next step Sirens?
Maybe. She's got it.
Because that's like the only thing. Well, it's like the only thing she ever did. Yeah, she sat in a pool. She sat in a pool with a top off with I don't even remember who, like
Kate
I think
Fisher.
Kate Fisher. Yeah.
But was Ben Mendelsohn in that?
He was.
No,
he was.
Oh, was he?
Was.
He was. I don't even remember that. I was thinking Sirens.
He played Lewis. It wasn't a huge role, but he was in it.
No, it was not a huge role.
Exactly.
I mean, I barely remember that Elle Macpherson was in it, except for the somewhat unsavory reason that she had a top. I mean, good God.
Look, thank you. Look, that was fantastic. Look, how did you go at home? Let us know your path. And if you got there faster than we did on social media, that's hashtag the televisionaries, hashtag 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Kylie.
Thank you, Linesman. Thank you, Ball Boys. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
That's it from us. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Adado. Kylie is at Melbourne Bitter, and myself at Lou_Ruge. You can also read stories by us on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugendijk. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by Lap Fan, and our head of audio is Tom McKendrick.